He had made waves at his birth, you know, what with the star and the shepherds and all that crazy stuff going on. But he hadn't really begun his public ministry yet. The first 30 years of his life, he spent trying to become everything that God knew he could be, becoming who he was destined to be, and spent a lot of time learning and growing. Now, people called him rabbi and teacher. And one of the things we have to understand about that is that that wasn't a title just anybody could have. He got that the traditional way. He got that through strenuous education and becoming an exceptionally well-versed individual when it came to the Hebrew texts. And so this rabbi comes to the Jordan River where this crazy dude in a camel hair gown who eats locust is baptizing people. And he, of course, steps into the water and is baptized by John. And John is actually even a little prophetic about it. And it opens up and reminds him that says, you know, a lot of people are pretty impressed with what I'm doing here. In fact, they take pride in it. They go back and they say, I was baptized by John in the River Jordan. But he says, you know, as special as you think I am, as close to God as you think I am, there's somebody coming who I'm not even worthy to untie their sandals. If you remember from a couple weeks ago, or a couple months ago, really, we talked about the significance of sandals and feet in the Hebrew culture. That was very taboo. That was where the sin lived. That was where the bad stuff happened. You didn't touch feet. You didn't touch sandals. You didn't touch shoes. It was all very, very offensive. And John is giving this extraordinarily profound statement by saying that I'm so unworthy in the presence of Christ that I'm not even good enough to touch one, and everybody else I'd be too good to touch. Just by virtue of being a Jew, I'm too good to touch your sandals, but I'm not even good enough to untie Jesus'. So he gives this profound statement and he baptizes Jesus, and it is that point that in the Christian tradition that Jesus began his public ministry. It's from that point forward that we really consider Jesus to have begun preaching the gospel and helping people to understand who God is. And it's an extraordinarily important season in the Christian year. It's a time for us to remember our own baptism. And that means, you know, a lot of us were baptized as children, so you say, remember your baptism? Well, I don't really remember that. But to remember your baptism means to remember why you were baptized and to remember that you who are baptized are part of a church that's been called to move forward for God. Baptism of the Lord's Sunday is an important season of the year because it helps us to remember who Jesus is and where he came from and who he came for. The significance for us today really is everything. It's remembering our own baptism. It's recognizing our own calls in the world. And it's understanding that we serve this triune God. And it's understanding that Jesus came not just to save the world, but to serve the world. Now, Romans 15 isn't a passage that we typically associate with the baptism of the Lord. Typically, we stick to the Synoptic Gospels, right? Typically, we stick to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Mark was our lectionary scripture for this morning. A lot of times, John is used, and the reason John is used is because that also includes the part of the story where the clouds open up and God speaks, and it's a little more detailed. John usually is a little more detailed on these issues. But even in Mark's Gospel, we see the profoundness of what happened. We see the profoundness of God looking at Jesus and saying, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. But of course, one of the key components of Christ's public baptism was that it began his public ministry. And Paul encourages us with these words. He says this. He says, we who are strong must be considerate of those who are sensitive to things like this. We can't just make ourselves happy. We should help others to do what's right and build them up in the Lord. Even Christ didn't just do what made Christ happy. Now, I'm paraphrasing it to simplify the language a little bit, but you get the idea of what Paul was talking about. Paul was saying that the Christian life isn't about what we do for ourselves, it's about what we do for others. There's nobody else in the history of the universe more qualified to live for themselves than Jesus. Nobody in the history of the universe has a better excuse for just living life for themselves, to make themselves happy, and to be better for themselves than Jesus. But he didn't, right? We know that very well. And that's the reason baptism of the Lord starts an important part of the Christian year, because we recognize that Jesus began his ministry in servitude for others. Someone who didn't need to be baptized, the only person who didn't need to be baptized, was himself baptized as an image of the incredible importance of serving others. In baptism, we die with Christ and then again are risen with Christ. And in Jesus, giving us this example, gives us this extraordinary revelation of what Romans 15 is talking about. Now, we're beginning this new series. We talked about it last week. We're beginning it this week with radical hospitality. Now, radical hospitality is the first of these five practices, these five New Year's resolutions for us as a church. And really, there is no better Sunday to kick that off than Baptism of the Lord Sunday, than to recognize what Jesus did and meant with his own baptism. Jesus came to serve others, not to serve himself, even though he was more than qualified to serve himself. Radical is a funny word, but it has a very specific meaning. Okay, to be radical means to go beyond what's expected. That could be good or bad, right? Radical is a word that can be positive or negative. And it means to go beyond what's expected. It means to go beyond what people anticipate. And it means to go beyond what's normal, right? So if someone is radically generous, that means that they give of themselves more than what we would consider normal, right? Somebody who gives a 10% tithe, we'd consider maybe a little above normal, but doing pretty good. Somebody who would give their last dollar to feed somebody without feeding themselves, we'd call them a little bit of a radical, right? Certainly, in almost everything, Jesus was radical. He went way beyond what was called of him and way beyond what society would have deemed normal, right? Radical hospitality means applying that same logic to hospitality, to loving people. And there's an important thing to understand that hospitality is not the same thing as friendliness. Sometimes when we talk about hospitality in the church or elsewhere, when we talk about being hospitable in our home or being hospitable when we're out with others, what we really mean is friendly. And friendly is important, but friendly is not hospitality. Friendly is extending my hand for a handshake, as long as you're not sick. Friendly is offering you a cup of coffee that I poured myself. Friendly is going to the restaurant and saying, you want me to pick you something up on my way back? That's friendly. And it's nice, and it's good to be friendly, and it's good to be nice. But hospitality goes beyond that. Hospitality is finding somebody in a certain place in their life and loving them where they're at. Hospitality is saying that, you know what, you've got something going on, big or small. You live a life that's different than I do. You make decisions different than I do. I'm looking at you where you are, and I'm going to be where you are. And hospitality is looking at them and loving them and saying, but I'm not going to leave you there. I'm going to love you where you are, and I'm going to love you so much that I'm not going to leave you where you are. That's hospitality. It's profound and it's extraordinary, and it's very important, and it's very important to the church. And the church, you know, we talk about hospitality, and a lot of times that means, oh, well, we'll put a coffee pot out in the front area. That way, when visitors come in, we can give them a mug and some coffee, and we'll shake their hand, and we'll forget about them after that. But what if hospitality in the church looked like genuinely looking into the hearts of people and finding out what we as a church can do for them? What we as a church can do to help them grow in God. After all, why are we here? The purpose of us being here is to grow others in God. Radical hospitality means being Christ-like, being the people that God knows we can be. The thing is, I don't need to give you a 30-minute dissertation on what being Christ-like means. We could probably spend the entire year preaching about what being Christ-like means. But I think that we as human beings are pretty good at figuring it out. We think about the times that we have fallen short of who God knows we can be, and yet we were forgiven anyway. We think about the times when we were blessed beyond our wildest dreams and we had really done nothing to deserve it. Even better, we think about the times that we thought we did something to deserve it, and God humored us and allowed us to be blessed anyway, without recognizing that we still had not done anything to deserve it. Nothing close to what God had offered. Radical hospitality is being Christ for other people. It's opening our hearts and minds to them. I think one of the biggest struggles today is that we've confused hospitality with tolerance. Tolerance says, okay, you're in a different place in your life than I am. You feel a little bit differently about something that I do, and I'm just going to be okay with that. Radical hospitality is I am going to stretch my heart as wide open as it can, and I'm going to stretch my mind as open as it can be, and I am going to spend every ounce I can to understand you and where you are and why you feel the way that you do. I'm going to be so vulnerable that I can say that, you know what, my understanding of you so that I can help you grow in God is more important than me staying stone cold in where I already am. In fact, I am going to be so convinced and so impartial to you that I am going to give you and I to God, and I'm going to let God sort out what's really important. Friendliness is saying that, you know, you think differently than I do, you look differently than I do, you dress differently than I do, you vote differently than I do, and that's okay with me. Hospitality is, I want to know why you're different than me, and I want to know how our differences can be used together to work better for God. And I really want to understand you and where you're coming from and find out where God is calling me in the midst of all of this. And again, we love the people where they are. We get to know where they really are. And then we love them too much to leave them where they are. That's what radical hospitality is all about. Now, obstacles to hospitality are plenty, the chief of which is the enemy's constant reminder that we are somehow better. We who are strong, as Paul says. So Paul was the early Christian leader, right? Paul was the first, really the first connectional, ecclesiastical leader in the church. The church was very loosely organized in the first century. He had churches in Ephesus, in Corinth, in Rome, in Egypt, in Africa. And these churches' theologies were different. Like, we talk about different churches now, right? So there are some differences. I just came from Fairview, right? The two churches in the same denomination. Their worship is a little bit different. The people look a little bit different. The building looks a little bit different. But for the most part, they're the same. Heck, we could even go down the street to First Baptist down there and crash their party. And we'd find a few differences here and there. But for the most part, we'd understand a basic concept of the triune God and that Jesus came for our sins, right? We would have that concept down. Go back to the first century. Go to Corinth and then go to Rome. You're not going to be able to understand how the two can both call themselves Christian. For one, at one point, the church in Corinth wasn't even sure if they were Christian. They thought, well, maybe we're supposed to follow Paul, or maybe we're supposed to follow John the Baptist. We don't understand. The church at Ephesus was kind of a retirement home for the apostles and even for Mary, possibly. But even with all of that power and teaching, they struggled with their own theology and struggled with basic concepts like communion and the Trinity. They really struggled with these things. Remember that the early church didn't have a Bible. They had the Old Testament. That's what they called the Bible. And they had writings, bits and pieces. Maybe the church at Ephesus had Mark's gospel, and maybe Rome was borrowing John's, and they had copies, and sometimes these copies were wrong. Sometimes the copies were modified before they ended up getting to the church, and that's why the Council of Nicaea was formed, to try and figure out what's right and produce a manuscript and produce the best Bible we possibly can for what we have. But the early church didn't have a Bible. Jesus didn't leave us with the New Testament. That came much, much later, decades later, hundreds of years in some cases and some pieces later. And, excuse me. And so these churches were loosely organized, and they struggled with their theology, and Paul kind of understood his responsibility to bring it all together. The reason we read from Paul so much, the reason we read so many of Paul's letters, isn't because Paul is particularly special, right? Paul wasn't set aside by God to be the most important theologian in the history of the universe. He may be, but that's not why he was set aside. In some ways, he is anyway. But Paul sought a responsibility of developing basic theology in all the churches. So Paul went to First Baptist, St. Clair United Methodist, and the Presbyterian Church, and wrote them all a letter and said, this is what you need to believe. Don't worry about the differences. This is what you need to believe. So Paul goes to Ephesus and to Rome and all these other places, and he writes them their letters. And these letters all contain basic Christian theology. Christianity 101 is what Paul wrote. And it's the basics of who God is, who Jesus is, why we worship God, why we worship Jesus, and why the Gospels are important. So Paul does this, and he has this extraordinary responsibility, and he goes to Rome, and Rome is feeling pretty good about themselves, because here's the thing about Rome. In Rome, the penalty for being one of these Christians was pretty severe, at least in parts of Rome. It was moving in the right direction, but for many Romans, they were still persecuted, still hiding in the shadows. In some areas of Rome, it was tolerated, but if it got too loud or too popular, chances are the Roman government was going to come in and shut you down in a very, very, very big way. Paul himself, of course, was imprisoned in Rome. And this Christian faith wasn't something that Caesar was a fan of. It really challenged his role as God of the people. It really challenged his role when you mix religion into things. Caesar understood that religion splits people's... my goodness, I just forgot the word. What's that word where you splits their allegiance? There you go. Yeah, well, I guess that cold weather's getting to me. So Caesar understood that religion splits allegiance. You can't be truly and genuinely allied with a nation if you have a genuine and true faith in God, right? It's impossible. I don't care how patriotic you are. I don't care how many flags you got in your house. I don't care how many of them you waved on your way up here. It is impossible for you to genuinely be a follower of God and put your country first. It's impossible. Because genuine faith in God puts an allegiance in your heart above everything on earth, including kingdoms that don't last forever. Now, Caesar understood that, so he wasn't happy about the idea of Christians. And so he pushed as hard as he could. And so the result of that in Rome is that the only Christians left are those willing to die for it. Those who were seeking, thinking about it, they got weeded out pretty fast, right? Only those Christians who were willing to die for it existed really in Rome. And that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing because that meant that those who might get to that point will never have had the opportunity to get to that point. But it does mean that their theology is less watered down because these people very strongly understood the Gospels. They worked hard to understand the Gospels. And so Paul writes in this letter, and basically he wrote letters to Rome too with basic theology, but he writes this letter. He says, we who are strong, in other words, you guys have got to figure it out. Quit worrying so much about figuring it out. Quit worrying so much about how much stronger you are than the others. Instead, focus on what you can do to make others as strong as you. Don't be so quick to judge. Our Christian life isn't here to serve ourselves. We're not supposed to. If Paul were talking to us today, he would say, those of you who are here every Sunday, those of you who are in Sunday school every morning, those of you who read your Bible every day, those of you whose theology is strong, those of you who could probably pass off a theological dissertation that might get you a PhD at a good seminary, those of you who are incredibly strong and grounded in your faith, remember that Jesus didn't come to serve himself. Jesus didn't come to sit and talk to himself and about himself. And likewise, the church isn't here to glorify us for how good we've already got it. The church exists to go outside those walls and to serve the people who haven't yet gotten it. You know, the church is often a misunderstood place because, for first off, the church isn't a place for evangelism. It often is, and that's the beauty of the church, is that it can be lots of things, but that's not its purpose. That's not what it was built for. This building wasn't built for people to walk in and understand God for the first time, because chances are somebody who doesn't have a faith in God would never set foot in here. Our responsibility as the church, not the building, but the people, is to go out and evangelize, to go out and be radically hospitable and tell people about this extraordinary God. When we become a church like Rome, we have the temptation to sit around and talk about how great we are. And suddenly we forget to go out and talk to others about how great God is. So Paul gives us this extraordinary call to be hospitable. I want you to think about this week, a time that somebody was hospitable to you, not friendly. Friendly is cool. There's lots of friendly people. Friendly is great. Still be friendly. Don't stop being friendly. Don't go home and say, well, I don't have to be friendly anymore because Pastor John said I should be hospitable instead of friendly, so that means I'm going to be neither. No, still be friendly. But think about a time somebody was hospitable for you, meaning that they came to you, saw a need, and saw a way to fill that need. They loved you where you were and loved you too much to leave you there. I bet you all have a story like that. I remember that this is a story that's always stuck with me for whatever reason. It's kind of funny, isn't it, how our memories stick with us, even those that aren't that profound. And this is a small snippet. This took 30 seconds, a little bitty exchange. I had this dog named Nala. She was a pit bull. She's a big pit bull. Pit bulls aren't very big, but she was big even for a pit bull. And very muscular, right? And we got her from a rescue. Our neighbor was a Jefferson County sheriff at the time. And he knew that we loved animals, and he had raided a puppy mill where they were breeding dogs to fight, and they were putting these dogs down because they had been bred to fight, and these dogs were way too small to have ever been, you know, tainted. I think Nala was only 5 years. We were bottle feeding her when we first got her, and he said, look, they're going to destroy this dog. I'll take one. You take one. We got to bottle feed them. We'll do what we can, and we did. We raised these dogs, and they were good friends, and we walked them all over the neighborhood, but pit bulls have a bad rap, especially when they come from a situation like that. And I would walk this dog, and I would even get yelled at sometimes. I actually had a guy come out and scream at me because, and I was only about 10 years old, by the way, and he came out and said, you know, my little girl's running around this neighborhood, and you've got that vicious thing running around here, and he's going to kill somebody one day. And he's just wagging his tail, you know, his tongue hanging out. He's the friendliest dog in the world, scared to death of cats. Actually, his biggest fear was this neighborhood alley cat that would chase him in the backyard, and he would hunker down and whimper up against the door waiting for somebody to let him in because this mean cat was looking at him. But even so, just by virtue of being a pit bull, people were just deathly afraid of this dog and just absolutely were upset that this dog was in their neighborhood. And so one day I'm walking this dog, and it's, I don't know, 102, 103 degrees out, very, very hot summer day. And when you're 10 years old and you're walking a pit bull, you're not really doing anything. You're just kind of walking behind and offering suggestions, and the dog lets you know if he agrees or not. And we're walking around, and the dog starts getting hot, so he sits down. And I tell her, I said, you know, we're not very far from home. Let's, you know, kind of pull it on a leash. I'm like, let's go back home if you're getting tired. And the dog wants to sit down, so we compromised, and we sat down. And you know, she's panting, and I'm scratching her behind the ears and giving her a little bit of rest. And you know, she wasn't in any danger. I wasn't worried about her having a heat stroke or something, but she was definitely getting tired, dehydrated, and it was time to go home. And the house we sat in front of, an older man, had to be in his 80s or 90s, came out with a Tupperware container full of water. And he kind of shuffled along. He had a walker in front of him and a double cup of water in the other hand. And he shuffled forward and he laid the water in front of the dog, who scarfed it up in seconds. And he just said, he looked at me, he said, "Here, your dog looked thirsty." And he went back inside. I mean, that was such a small moment in my life. It really didn't do anything profound. The dog would have been fine. I'd have walked her home and given her water just the same. But it was someone who, in the midst of a neighborhood that wasn't a fan of a little friendly brown dog who came from a breed that's known to be aggressive, and just to give her some love and some care, to offer her a little bit of water, and to care for a 10-year-old boy who was trying to drag this dog around that was as big as him, there was radical hospitality. It was above the norm. It was beyond what was expected. It was not anything he should have had to do. He did it simply because of his love. His love for a kid he didn't know and for a dog he had no idea he had never met. That's what radical hospitality is. It's recognizing a need and being unwilling to leave that need unmet. So what I want us to do this week is to read and pray and understand what it means to be hospitable. I want us to really break down what that means to us. I want us to pray this week about becoming more hospitable. I think you already do. I'm sure that you already pray to become closer to God. But this week, pray especially to become more radically hospitable. I believe very strongly that the Christian life is about being more today than I was yesterday and stronger tomorrow than I ever was before. There are times we slip backwards, but the Christian life is about moving forward. My prayer for us is that this week we might pray to become more Christ-like in our hospitality, that we might become more Christ-like in understanding. In Bishop Snazy's book, he quotes Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich is an author, and when Bishop Snazy was a teenager, he read this book. And a quote in this book is extremely important, and it's simple, and it says, "Accept that you are accepted." That's the Christian life in one sentence. Accept that you are accepted. The Christian life isn't about making sure that you're better than everybody else. The Christian life isn't about checking off all the boxes and making sure that you've gotten into heaven. The Christian life really isn't even about getting into heaven. The Christian life really isn't even about being this perfect Christian. The Christian life is about recognizing that there's a God who loves you, infinitely and profoundly loves you, wants to spend eternity with you, and has already accepted you, and has asked in return only that you respond to his grace and accept that you are accepted by God. This is extraordinarily profound in a couple of words, and it sums up radical hospitality. When we accept that we're accepted, then we can accept that others are accepted. That regardless of where they are in their life, and certainly it'll change, being accepted by God means moving forward and changing and becoming better and better each day, but it has to start somewhere. Accepting that we're accepted and being radically hospitable means accepting that others are accepted as well and helping them to understand their acceptance. So my prayer for us this week is that we would profoundly and truly and infinitely understand what that means, how this attitude of helping and hospitality is going to grow and cultivate the next generation of Christians. Worship and serving God is not about us, it's about God. It's about what we do for God. And radical hospitality is much the same. What we do for God by doing for others. So pray about that this week. Pray about how God is going to use you in the coming weeks and months and years and lifetimes. And pray about how we can be radically hospitable to others by showing this infinite love to help others understand, to accept that they are accepted. Amen.